Welcome back to Fear or Favour, our pre-Christmas edition. How are you, Nazir? Done all your shopping?
Oh, well, thank you. No, I have not done any shopping. It's actually scandalous. But anyway, all my children are going to provide me with a list, apparently. It's what they do these days. And when they provide me with a list, I will be going online and getting stuff. I've been spending today training Swedish prosecutors and Swedish police officers in English.
Okay.
So that was quite an entertaining little session.
And what's the policing system like in Sweden?
It's obviously well-resourced, which I'm sure we'll come on to when we discuss our subject today. They've spent a lot of money on policing and on investigations more generally, and they seem to have lots of specialists, the kind of stuff that we used to have, I imagine.
Brilliant. Well, I've had a really good week, and you may well have heard about it in the news, but basically since 2018, I've been working with a family whose daughter vanished in 1980. Her body was found in 1989, hidden in undergrowth. Her hands had been tied by her own bra. She was naked. At that time, the police did not classify it as murder. And fast forward to now, and we have worked really, really hard since 2018 with the family and an amazing legal team to bring the case back to court, having been successful with the Attorney General to hear it back at the High Court. And this week we had that quashed. So the initial coroner's verdict has now been quashed, and it is now a new inquest that will be heard. And very significantly, the Chief Constable of Sussex Police has acknowledged that the initial investigation in 1980 and 89 was flawed. And we'll talk a little bit more about the issues of police investigations. But I think it's prudent that we talk about the lack of action on certain high profile cases that have made massive news headlines over the past few weeks and also in the recent days. It is scandalous to a degree, isn't it?
It's more than scandalous. The public have begun to think that there's one law for some people and another law for the bulk of them. And when you have a situation when, there's people saying that they will be treated very differently if you've got lots of money and lots of power, that really damages policing across the board.
Mm. And let's look at the specifics. So we have a photograph that's emerged now in relation to a party that took place at Number 10. We've also got video footage of a so-called mock conference that took place. And of course, the Prime Minister has been very clear to say, well, there were no Christmas parties and everybody complied with COVID. The problem is that the evidence doesn't tell us that, does it?
No, it's worse than that, because the police have said at commissioner level that there's nothing to investigate, that there is no evidence. Well, and I know that's what the police are meant to do. They're meant to find the evidence. And here on this case, the Daily Mirror, amongst other newspapers, have put it on a plate for them. And yet they still maintain that there's nothing to investigate. I think it needs to be said. I mean, I was actually on the National Police Chief's COVID's policing group. So that came into being last April, so just after COVID first lockdown. What the police wanted to do, and it's really good of them to do this, they wanted a group of people from across the sector, including me and including bishops and others, doctors and others, to help them guide them in terms of what their policy should be in policing COVID breaches. And very early on, Mark, they came to the conclusion that some of the investigations they were being asked to conduct were, how can I put it, malicious, i.e. Mm. And your neighbour.
So what, someone like phoning up as a neighbour?
Yeah, well, this is what was happening. As a neighbour was ringing up and saying, my next door neighbour has got people round and shouldn't.
Yes.
And in those cases, the police were happy to investigate. But then there were people ringing up and saying, last week, my neighbour had people round. Well, they were going, how are we going to investigate that? When we go around, there'll be nobody there. So it'll be your word against the word of the person next door. Now, there were hundreds of those, if not thousands of those types of inquiries, reports being made. And so the police came to the policy decision that they would no longer investigate, their language, retrospective allegations of COVID breaches. That means that if they weren't present at the time, or they weren't called to deal with it at the time, they wouldn't investigate that. And I can see the logic behind that.
Yeah, so that's a very clear policy decision to not to investigate COVID, only COVID,
yes,
COVID cases where it's retrospective, where it hasn't happened at the time. And if we look at the details, I mean, they are very, very serious. I mean, you know, last November, the country was in a lockdown. And in that period of time and leading up to Christmas, there was two parties, 40 to 50 people attending each event, and staff told to leave via the back door. Now, that's clearly a very coordinated, don't be seen, walk out via the back door. But because it's happened previously, i.e. it's not happening now, the policy decision of the Metropolitan Police is not to investigate. Is that right?
That's exactly it. The problem with that policy, though, in these circumstances, is the police were there. This was Downing Street. This was Conservative Party headquarters, which is obviously well policed for security reasons. So it's hard for them to argue that the policy applies here, which I don't know how they're maintaining this argument, actually. You know, the police, you know, as I said, if they weren't present in real time, then we cannot possibly investigate it. That's the policy.
Yeah.
Well, you were present in real time. You know, 10 Downing Street, you can't get in unless you go through the police security.
I suppose it's quite interesting because, I mean, I know the security and how it works quite well at Number 10. I've got someone that used to be very high up within Number 10 police protection. So the PM has his own specialist protection officers. But when the PM's in Number 10, he's left alone. So he doesn't have those officers with him specifically. And of course, Number 10, I think it's quite hard for people, if you haven't been in Number 10, to understand just how big it is. It's a myriad of offices of all those houses joined together. So it is a big, big place. And you can go in there without seeing anybody else. Plus also the DPG. So this is the Diplomatic Protection Group. And many people will recognize them because they drive around London in the red vehicles. And the Diplomatic Protection Group, they have a 2 hours on, 2 hours off rotation. So they may not then go back to their point. And I suppose the point is that, and I don't know if this is their argument, are they saying, well, we didn't have a record of that? But the problem is ultimately the whole thing falls down because at any one time, the police would have to know who is in Number 10.
That's exactly it. I mean, it
for security and fire purposes.
Mark, it doesn't stand up to scrutiny. As I said, I accept the policy decision that retrospective COVID breaches shouldn't be investigated, prosecuted. The other thing to be said about that, by the way, because is that there is no chance of a private prosecution. The law is very clear on COVID regulations. The only people that can investigate are the police, and the only people that can prosecute are the Crown Prosecution Service. Because I did consider this in another life. I was responsible for investigating Dominic Cummings, who,
yes,
as you know, was the president.
Who
the
breached?
Prime Minister's
I mean, he clearly breached the rules, didn't he? Cummings clearly broke rules.
100% he broke the rules. We carried out an investigation, which I then presented to the police in November or October of 2020. And the police came back and said, we don't retrospectively investigate. And I said, well, I've done it for you, by the way. And they said, we don't retrospectively investigate.
Just remind everyone, Nazir, what the circumstances Cummings were.
He was the Prime Minister's special advisor. He was very, very early on, almost immediately, actually, after lockdown was instituted. He decided to take his family from London all the way to Durham, where he has a family home, and he was by his own admission, COVID infected at that time. And of course, part of me was thinking, hang on a minute, he's now taken COVID from COVID Central, which was London, all the way to Durham, and you know, potentially infected people up there. That's the public interest, in my view, in why it was important. He stayed up there for a week or more, and then came back down. And this came to light eventually after a Daily Mirror investigation. Daily Mirror seemed to be very good at this.
Pippa Creera, the political editor, Pippa Creera, she's very good. And I have to say, I think she should be singled out for some of the work that
100%,
she's done. 100%.
And so they came to light. Then you had the ridiculous sight of Dominic Cummings, who technically is a civil servant, giving a press conference in the Rose Garden at Downing Street. If I can't remember, can you, I was a civil servant. Nobody ever gave me the opportunity to deliver a press conference. No. Anyway, he did, and he gave he came up with this that he needed childcare. That's the reason why he was ill. His wife was ill. They needed childcare, which is why they went to the family. Subsequently, some months later, he said, no, that wasn't the reason. I went up there for security reasons. And I thought because he was being harangued outside of his house in London. Well, you know, which is it? Anyway, the point is that the evidence was clear that he had breached it. It was really troubling because of the fact that he took COVID with him to the northeast of England.
Yeah.
At a time when you're not supposed to do that. I tried to get the police to provide me with AMPR data, all sorts of stuff, to be able to show that what he had done was a breach of COVID regulations. There's no doubt in my mind, and anybody's mind, that was the case. But the police decided, because it was retrospective, they weren't going to investigate it, stroke prosecute it, and I couldn't privately prosecute it because the law doesn't allow it. So we're here again. We've got COVID regulations in place. We've got parties taking place and in clear breach of the regulations that exist at the time. But the difference is the police were present. On any account, the police would have been outside of Downing Street or in the vicinity, so they would have been aware. And so I find it a challenge for the commissioner and the Metropolitan Police to say, we will take no action in these circumstances, whereas I can possibly accept it, belatedly accept it, in Cummings's case. I cannot accept it in these circumstances.
Cummings also, I mean, I don't know who quite advised him to give his view or give his account, but someone obviously told him that it might be quite a good idea to say that you drove some distance to test your eyesight.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that was the hilarity of it. It's, you know, and I know what tends to happen in a case. If I generally defendants do this, not that I'm saying that Cummings is a defendant, is that they fit their story to the evidence as it comes out. So initially, it wasn't known that he had gone to somewhere called Barnard Castle, a lovely little place in Durham. It wasn't known. So when he gave his original account, he didn't mention it. Then subsequently, he came out. Hang on a minute. You said you were getting childcare in your house in Durham. What the hell were you doing in Barnard Castle that day? Oh, okay, I went to check my eyesight. Before I drove all the way back to London, I needed to check my eyesight. And that became a meme and a half, that did. I mean, the idea that Barnard Castle, which is a lovely place, became associated with eye tests. The fact that he wanted to drive 30 miles to test his eyesight before he drove 250 miles is a complete and utter nonsense, but it became a right joke, didn't it? And the reality is that there's no doubt, there's no questioning whatsoever that he breached the COVID regulations. And of course, even worse than that, actually, Mark, the Spectator magazine, which his wife works for, he wrote a piece, both of them wrote a piece for Spectator whilst they were ill in the northeast of England, without mentioning that they were ill in the northeast of England at the same time. So, there's all sorts of shenanigans going on here. But, I'm not going to ask them to relook at Cummings, but what we have is a live issue here, which is why is it that the police are maintaining that they cannot investigate Downing Street and the parties that took place in December of 2020, when the police were present, which, as it runs a coach and horses through their policy.
Mm. And of course, if they were present, which they clearly would have been because it has security, they allowed it to take place.
Yeah, and there's also, I've already said something about this, and I'll say it again. All right, let's assume for a moment that they won't prosecute for COVID regulation breaches because, quote unquote, it's retrospective. If the police were present, well, the police, there's no if about it, the police were present, were they told by anybody in the Prime Minister's office not to do anything about it?
Yeah.
Now, if they were, unfortunately for them, they've committed an even more serious offence of perverting the course of justice, which you know and I know carries a life imprisonment sentence as a maximum. So never mind a £10,000 fine. Potentially, there's another crime that needs investigating, which is that they've interfered with a police investigation of a COVID breach at the time the breach took place.
You see, I find it really difficult, and obviously being an ex-police officer, I find it really difficult to believe that one or more of those officers on duty on that evening would not have raised their concern with either a supervisor or directly with the individuals either at number 10 or through that party, because they wouldn't have complicitly allowed an offence to take place. I cannot believe overwhelmingly the officers wouldn't have done that. So the question is, were they instructed not to do it, not to stop it from happening? And if so, by who? And I think the first part has definitely got to have been made out. They must have been told not to pursue it. The question is, who asked them not, or who told them not to pursue it? Was it a senior police officer, or was it somebody within the government and number 10?
Absolutely. And that is why they need to investigate. the evidence, we've seen the evidence of the events taking place. We can correctly surmise that the police were present. We know that the police did nothing. So the next question are the two questions you've asked. And those are matters of public interest and potentially of a serious offence of perverting the course of justice, which is not bound by their policy of not retrospectively investigating, and more serious than actually the COVID breaches. And so I can't see for the life of me why it is that the investigation hasn't taken place. And of course, what it's doing, Mark, is it's massively damaging. You know, here we are now, the government announcing more measures because of the most recent variant that's taken place, and telling us to, not have parties and keep away from family, et cetera, et cetera. How can anybody think that that's credible, given you did what you did a year ago when it was as bad, if not worse? And so it's damaging to the public interest. It's damaging to public health. It's damaging to public confidence. How much more damaging does it need to be?
I mean, it's damaging on every level, isn't it? From a political level, from a governmental level, from an education level, as far as the COVID goes. One of the things that I'd be interested to see what your take is, you know, I'm very clear, is that I think the commissioner, Cressida Dick, has played a very, very bad hand here. And I think her handling of the whole situation has been really poor. I think in the first place, her explanation around not dealing with it retrospectively is not being made clear. You know, she hasn't emphatically said it's around simply a policy decision around COVID and explained that. And then secondly, she hasn't explained the position of the fact that there must have been police officers there on the day. And indeed, when she was on LBC and she was being asked around this, she answered in a political way, which was simply to circumnavigate the question and not answer it. Surely we need a leader at the top of the Metropolitan Police.
I shouldn't have to explain the police's policy, but I'm having to do that. You know, the police should be doing that. I shouldn't have to explain the potential other crimes that may have been committed if the evidence bears it out. It's a terrible indictment, really, of the leadership of the Met at the moment. I mean, I've spoken about it publicly and I've written about it publicly. I feel that the commissioner is acting a bit like a human shield for the government. You know, she takes all the flak, so none of it ends up on there.
Isn't that the problem? We've talked about this before, and in fact, I've talked about it quite recently in a presentation I did. And you know, this is a tripartite policing system that we have in the UK, which is unique to other countries. You know, the whole point of the police service is that we're not to be dictated to by government. It isn't the government. The police service isn't, by legislation, and certainly shouldn't be, the arm and the voice of the government. Yeah. But more and more, it seems that it is.
The police operate, there's a, as you say, an unwritten rule, which accepted by everybody, I thought, which is that nobody gets involved in operational decisions made by police. That means that nobody's above the law, that the law acts without fear or favour, which is what we're about. And what we have is a situation where it doesn't matter what the reality is, the perception is that there are people interfering. So we had Cash for Honours investigations in the early to mid-2000s, and that was allegations being made that people were paying money to government and to donors in order to get an honour from the Queen. And that was investigated by the police pretty well, as it happens. At the end of the day, it was the investigation stopped because, for legal reasons, they couldn't prove the link between the money and the honours. Then we had, if you remember, expenses. parliamentary expenses allegations made in the late 2009, 2010, which were covered very extensively in the Telegraph at that time. And that led to some prosecutions. Some MPs went to jail. And, you know, that showed again that there is an independent police force doing its independent job.
And I think that was actually that was a very good thing for society as a whole, because what it did show for quite a long time that actually the Metropolitan Police and other police forces were prepared to take action against MPs who, by and large, are pretty unaccountable. You know, you can't sack an MP.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people, you know, MPs were taking the proverbial, weren't they? You know, they were taking money for duck ponds, for third homes, fourth homes, all sorts of stuff. And so it showed the public that, as you say, police MPs can only, at that time, you couldn't do what you can now, which is recall them for another election, potentially. That's, if you were an MP, you were MP until the next election, but despite whether you were dishonest or not. So here we were, prosecutions were brought, people were convicted, sends out a very strong message that the police are independent and acting independently. That has been somewhat neutralized in recent years, particularly during the COVID period, where the perception now is that that there's some direction or some pressure. I said, I don't know what the reality is. The reality doesn't matter to my mind. The perception we're left with is that the police are being told at a senior level, don't look there, don't go there. And that, as I say, is damaging in the extreme, because people will think one law for them and another law for us.
And I think in a way that, of course, does apply, because I think there's probably a lot of people out there up and down the country who have been spoken to, perhaps given official warnings in relation to the COVID breaches. I mean, what I would like to have seen, or what I'd still like to see, is the commissioner to show some guts and to come out and say every single person that attended that event that we can evidence and show, because actually there's photographs to show it, will be given an official warning for breach of COVID.
Yeah, absolutely.
At the very least, give them an official warning for breach of COVID, or every single one of those. That is what should be being done. That will give some kind of confidence that, you know what? The police will investigate matters and take them seriously, no matter who you are. But the problem is that, one, that's not going to happen. And it is about who you are. You could almost be, do whatever you want sitting within government now. And I think it would be very difficult for the police to prosecute you because of that power that seems to be coming from the top down.
We had the unedifying sign of a large PowerPoint presentation outside of Scotland Yard, where Adrian Dunbar, the actor from Line of Duty, was outlining the evidence against the government and saying, you know, Mom, as in the commissioner, can you not see? Never mind. You don't have to do investigation. Here's the investigation. And you know, that leads, when you're laughing at the police, that is a bad place that we've got to. You know, when you're laughing at them. And I think that, you know, again, Adrian Dunbar, when Line of Duty was broadcast, there was one particular scene where he says, in character, he says, what's happened to truth and honesty and integrity? And a lot of people went, yeah, what has happened to truth and honesty and integrity?
And I think you get to the heart of some of these major cases. I mean, you look at the murder of Morgan with the axe in the car park. You know, I mean, Daniel Morgan's murder was not only appallingly investigated, it was absolutely corruptly investigated. It was sabotaged, and sabotaged continually up until the point where the family, Morgan's family, have fought so hard to try and get some kind of recognition from the police. And
they got that, didn't they? That wasn't the report said. Inquiry
they have
said,
now.
They are institutionally corrupt. That investigation was institutionally corrupt.
Absolutely appalling. And you can look at other cases where that applies. And
Stephen Lawrence.
Stephen Lawrence.
The original inquiry to Stephen Lawrence was institutionally racist. So you can point to so many high profile. These are the high profile ones, by the way, Mark. There will be others that the only people who know about are the people who are involved in them, where they will have a sense that they weren't treated fairly, that they weren't treated equitably, that it wasn't properly investigated. We've talked before about rape. You know, there's a view that if you have a conviction rate of 1.4%, that means that you've raped rape has been decriminalized. You know, the reality is that, you know, as I said, the reality doesn't matter anymore. The perception is that there are some things the police will look at, there are some things the police won't look at, and very often who you are makes a decision, or, you know, affects the decision as to whether something is investigated.
Over the years, I have been fairly supportive of Cressida Dick. I think there is a very different position as being the leader from the top and how accountable you can be for when things take place down below. In other words, you know, if you've got an area officer that makes a mistake or something that happens much lower down, you know, Cressida Dick, I don't believe the very senior managers can be held accountable for that unless it's a clear policy decision. I think individual officers and supervisors need to be held accountable for that. But when the commissioner comes involved herself, as she has done with the most recent situations at the government level, then she has to be accountable. And I think her current position and her position in relation to some of the behaviour for previous inquiries, in particular, Daniel Morgan, because we know that she was involved in that element. I think there is a point now that Cressida Dick should stand down and we need to see a new leader at the top of the Metropolitan Police. There are some brilliant chief constables out there and deputy chief constables out there. There's some really great ones. And I'd love to see one of those take over the post, because Cressida Dick's time is over.
I won't disagree with you. I've written about it. I wrote about it in the Daily Mail where I called for her to step down. And I did so on the basis that you come to, like, there is a point where, you know, she's past that threshold. And it's damaging the whole of policing, and not just the Metropolitan Police, and not just her leadership. And I'm with you as well. I know loads of chief constables, current chief constables, and I know how capable they are. But I think people don't even, what's happened is that her contract has been extended by 2 years.
I know.
Never mind she steps down at the end of her contract. It's been, by the Home Secretary, it's been extended. And one of the reasons why it's been extended, I mean, this really, really, really irks me, is that the Home Secretary decided that there wasn't anybody that could step in at this time.
Yeah.
And that, what does that say about the chief constables we've just been talking about?
Yeah. I mean, when that came out, I couldn't believe it. You know, I'd spent probably, I think about the month before, I'd been with a chief constable who I rate incredibly highly, and we were talking, and actually that announcement hadn't been made. And he is destined definitely for the top. And there are some brilliant chiefs out there. And I think it's so sad. And it's, what a reflection to suggest that actually there is not the caliber to come through. Absolutely untrue. It's not the case.
It's damaging to morale. If you were that chief constable you mentioned, and I can think of several others who, you know, within a few years, they will be, you know, definitely commissioner material. And they've now been told by the Home Secretary, the person in charge of policing in this country, that you're not capable enough to take on the biggest role in policing. Well, I don't know how I would, you know, if somebody said to me, Nazir, you're not good enough to be chief prosecutor ever, I don't know how I'd carry on.
But see, the problem with this is that if you are running an organization, an establishment, the very people that you want to surround yourself with are very people that will make you look good. And the very people that will support you.
Yes.
They're not the people that will challenge you. It takes a very brave person to put in post somebody who is going to challenge their views and hold them to account. Now, that should be the reality and should be the norm, because we should all be confident enough in our own decision makings and actually want somebody out there to challenge us when we're putting something forward, just so that we get it right, because we're not always right. We don't always make the right decisions.
Nope.
And therefore, it's good to have checks and balances. But if you don't have the checks and balances of the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, when you are the Home Secretary or you're the Prime Minister, we've got a major problem.
We have. You end up like the echo chamber where everybody agrees with everybody else. The only people you hear from are the people who think like you, et cetera, et cetera. You know, all of that is really damaging to really effective work, never mind policing. And as I said, you know, morale is low. Morale amongst senior police officers is low. Morale amongst general police officers is low. We've talked before about how challenging it is. Let me make this abundantly clear. The bulk of policing in this country is phenomenal at what they do. But they aren't led necessarily across the board by people who are doing them a service. And I think the current stuff around lack of police action, the current perception that police don't investigate when it suits them or when it suits politicians is undoubtedly going to damage morale even more so. As you say, they've been giving out thousands of fixed penalty notices over the last year and a half, appropriately for people who've breached COVID. Some of them are quite famous people like Rita Ora and others. And then you had people like Kay Burley from Sky News being taken off Sky News for 6 months because she had a party. Those are real world consequences for people. And yet, if you're in politics, seemingly, at the highest level, there are no consequences.
And if I'm right, I'm sure Kay Burley's was retrospective, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It didn't happen at the time. It became known afterwards, didn't it?
Yeah, so, I mean, they didn't deal with her at the time, did they?
No,
dealt with it retrospectively.
Absolutely not. She paid the consequences, as have thousands of people, because they broke the COVID regulations, which are in place to protect us all. And, you know, it really is a damning indictment of policing at senior levels that, you know, the perception now is that, you know, if you're, if you're in the hands of the politicians or you got politicians in front of you, you will not provide them with the consequences that they deserve to have for what they've done.
I want to broaden this out a bit more. Obviously, we're looking in terms of the government and we're talking about those types of officials. But is it the case that there are certain people, because of their status and because of perhaps their celebrity, that they also evade justice?
Yeah.
Let's look at one case. So Katie Price has now been banned from driving for 6 times. And let me just take you through the small list. Actually, it's not small. October 2003, escapes a speeding charge on a technicality. June 2008, 3 points for talking on a mobile. July 2010, 4 points for speeding at 99 miles an hour. September 2010, 3 points for veering from her lane in her horse box. December, 6 points banned, 3 more points for driving in excess speed. She then had 13 points. August 2012, 12 month ban for failing to respond to 2 speeding tickets. February 2018, banned for 6 months for failing to give details about the person driving her speeding car. July, quizzed by police in relation to the speeding. September, crashes her Range Rover whilst allegedly on her mobile. October, held for suspected drink driving. December, charged over drink driving allegation. January 2019, 3 months banned for driving. February, further 3 months after driving, after conviction. And then autumn, issued with her sixth ban. We've got a situation now where she crashed her car in September. She went into the Priory. She received, obviously, whatever they do in the Priory to assist her in relation to her alcohol and drug usage, which she's been very open about. She went to court and she has now been given a 6th ban, a 2-year ban from driving, but not sent to jail. She's been given a suspended sentence. That, on every level, and I can tell you from a police officer's point of view, I can tell you from my colleagues I've spoken to who are up in arms. Indeed, yeah. The head of Surrey and Sussex policing unit is considering an appeal. Yeah. This is wrong. She should have gone to jail.
I mean, how can anybody argue against that? As I said, there's potentially an appeal being lodged. But, you know, she has absolutely no desire to comply with the law when it comes to driving. None. I mean, some of those offences, they're really serious. People don't appreciate, you know, as you know, if you're hit by a car that's travelling more than 30 miles an hour, you're likely to die. If you're disqualified from driving, that means you're not insured. So you hit somebody and kill somebody, potentially that's the end of their lives and they won't get any compensation. You know, there's all sorts of consequences that flow from this.
And add to that, alcohol and drugs.
And exactly that. And the fact that she's got, you know, she's got a disabled child, somebody else has to care for that child. There's all sorts of consequences that will flow from what she has done. And I, as you say, given what we're talking about, I wonder, there she is sat in front of the judge and the judge takes pity on her. And one of the things, you mentioned it a moment ago, you know, the moment she was arrested, she went into the Priory. That's happened a few times, and not just for her. There's a real sense in my mind that some lawyers advised you go into the Priory, get some treatment, and then we can put that as mitigation, saying, look, you're trying to address the underlying cause of your criminality, which of course, if you're rich, you can do that. You know, you can afford to go to.
But it was something that specifically the bench talked about, because they did actually say, you know, because you've been into priory, because you got this treatment, because of the way that you were dealt with at the last hearing, it made it not possible for me to give you a custodial sentence.
But it's not the first time she's been to priory. You know, so I think that there's absolutely, and I can see why they did that. But I, you know, between you and I and everybody else listening, I wonder whether or not, you know, that bit of manipulation of the system going on here, which again, if you're wealthy, you can do. You know, if you were poor, you couldn't afford to go to the priory, you take your penalty and you will go to prison for your sixth disqualification offense, you know. So I think, As you've said, there are certain people in certain circumstances with certain wealth and certain power and certain influence that will be able to get an outcome that you and I or the general public wouldn't get, and that clearly is not right.
And it is wrong, and it's got worse. It really has got worse to some degree. I think we went through a stage where, in the early 80s, 90s, to early 2000s, I do think that there was an awful lot of corruption. It existed, certainly in the 80s and 90s. I think it got better. It got considerably better. It was weeded out. There was much stronger individuals within authorities. But we're in danger of going right back to that point unless we're very careful. And some could argue we're already back there now. Yeah. How can you have somebody as powerful as the Prime Minister to get away with what they've done? Yeah. There seems to be no separation between the work of the police and the work of other individuals who
the police used to be accused of Freemasonry, you know, the Freemasonry element, didn't they? There used to be this perception that somehow, if you had a particular handshake, you'd be treated in a very different way by senior police. And I think they remedied that. They were much more transparent about the way things were being done. People didn't hide the fact they were members of Freemasons. I'm not a member of the Freemasons, by the way. But, you know, people were thinking that way. And that was one area or potential impact on. But, you know, the reality is that it doesn't matter now what they do. People have already made up their minds. They've made up their minds that there is something not right in policing. They've made up their mind that there's some judgments being made which are, never mind flawed, they're just plain wrong. And that there are certain people with it, certain positions or certain influence, certain money, certain power, that can do what they like, and there will be no consequences.
I think that's absolutely true. You know, you've talked about it a number of times, about the perception. You know, it doesn't matter talking about reality, it's the perception. And the perception is what causes so much damage. And if the public perception is that out there is one rule for one and one rule for another, you know, if you have money, it talks. And it has done for a long time in many things. I mean, listen, this isn't new. But what we have what as a society we hope is that there is a protection around being able to buy your freedom. You know, the likes of Thailand, the likes of the Far East, you know, some of those countries, we know the corruption exists. We know that you can buy your freedom out there. It's happened so many times. You know, sex offenders gets caught and the next thing is, you know, they're not going to jail. They've paid a certain amount of money. What we hoped is, of course, that the British criminal justice system isn't like that. And of course, it isn't to the same degree. But behind closed doors, these conversations that take place, this influence that's put upon people, and whether that be a direct influence or an indirect, simply because of who they are, they feel that they need to go down a certain route. That worries me massively.
Well, it does, and I think linked to that is the what are the consequences? You know, we've just said a moment ago that money shouldn't buy you out of consequences. A little while ago, as in a few days ago, NatWest Bank were fined £250 million because they had been facilitating money laundering. They turned a blind eye to money laundering. And that's money that will come out of their profits. It'll mean that they'll earn a little bit less in terms of profit. It means there'll be a slightly smaller dividend for their shareholders. But at the end of the day, that's it. No, but there's no one person, no CEO, no chief operating officer, no senior manager that will pay, literally pay for it, i.e. go to prison for it. Because what they, you know, and that I think also damages public confidence. The reality is, I don't know if you read that story, you know, there were people going into branches with black bags full of cash, with tens of thousands of pounds. Rather than, you know, hang on a minute, where's this come from? We'll just take it from you and put it into the account and charge you interest.
And it is a criminal offence to money launder. It's a criminal offence knowingly to do that. And if somebody turns up with
money, the money is paid. They've paid the fine from the Financial Conduct Authority, and that's the end of the matter. Well, I'm afraid, no, it shouldn't be. You know, we after the banking crisis in 2008-09, you know, when we had the massive financial crash, one person went to prison in the United Kingdom. You know, it gives the impression that if you're moneyed, or a corporate business with enormous profits and enormous contacts and links, that you will not pay the consequences. And, you know, and Joe and Jane from Barking in Essex or something, you know, whoever they are, the average person in the street, if they
they'll get prosecuted.
1 foot wrong, they're prosecuted.
Yeah. And that is, it's a bugbear. No, for both of us, because there are people out there who work really hard. You know, they're the general, you know, members of the public, and they may have made a mistake or they may have done something which has put them in the position where they're being prosecuted for something. They'll have the full weight of the law put upon
them.
This
whole podcast series is about giving Joe and Jane a voice. You know, it's about hearing from the people who are the general public and how they feel about the way the world works around them. And yeah, as you say, I've sat in a courtroom and I've seen this person crying their eyes out because they made one mistake.
Yeah.
And they will go to prison for X months away from their family or wherever it is. And yes, they committed to crime. And they'll be rehabilitated. I'll never, ever see them again in the courtroom afterwards. But they will lose confidence in a system when they see people committing even more heinous crimes, more public crimes, and never going anywhere near a courtroom.
And it's just lack of accountability, isn't it? It's a lack of accountability. It's a lack of the authorities taking on the very people who need to be held to account. There are so many people who seem to just get away with it. Now, whether that's criminality, whether that's because they failed to do their job right in the first place, you know, I think we all have a duty to do our job right. Now, whether you're a journalist, whether you're a prosecutor, whether you're a police officer, you have a responsibility. If you get it wrong, then you should be held to account for that. As long as you've had the appropriate training and it wasn't a mistake in terms of as much as you thought you were doing the right thing. You know, if you've failed in your duty, you have to be held to account. And we've talked about it in relation to children's services, to police officers. I am sick and tired of the very people who take job responsibility, but it's never acted upon. They're never held to account. And then that goes up the chain. It goes up to
and they're paid more. I mean, when you look at some of them are paid like twice the amount of money the Prime Minister gets. And very often the response when you challenge that is they have so much responsibility. And you think, hang on a minute. With great responsibility comes great accountability. I think I'm sort of paraphrasing what Spider-Man might have said. And the reality, of course, is that there isn't any accountability.
It doesn't.
There's no accountability. They take the money and they run.
With more money comes more freedom.
Yeah.
Less accountability, more freedom.
And better lawyers.
Better lawyers. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is. Honestly, we are. Right, we're going to carry on this. We're going to make sure that we keep bringing people to justice and challenging this terrible perception now that justice isn't for everybody.
Yeah. No, and I think it's so important. You know, I work really hard, and I know you do, in terms of fighting, giving the general member of the public a voice. And, you know, I work really hard to work with those people who've been forgotten, who've been left behind, to try and enable them to get some justice, to get some answers. When the police have failed and haven't got them that, let's see if we can go back to the beginning and restart it again. And I think there is we all have a duty. I think it's, you know, policing is all of us. We all have a responsibility. We're all part of the police force as a whole. You know, that's all of our roles. But what we have to do is make sure the police stand up to their side and they hold their bargain. But the problem is that more and more it's becoming lopsided. It's becoming, well, if you are a general member of the public, you're going to get hit much harder than if you're somebody who's right at the top of their scale, who's being paid an awful lot of money, who's got the power and the influence to change decisions that are made. That's not right. But I don't know how we change it.
We change everything one step at a time. And I think by shining a light on it in the way that we've been shining a light on these issues, that helps. But as I said, we can't allow it to just fester, because festering, I'm afraid, just damages everybody.
Mm. So we're quickly coming to an end. I think it's important to just reflect a little bit on the year. It's nearly Christmas. People will break up for Christmas. It's a difficult time again, whilst we aren't in a full lockdown. But COVID will be very much on people's minds again as they see loved ones. It's a difficult time of year, isn't it?
Not that I want to be Scrooge or anything, but, domestic abuse goes up. Some of the crimes that are most heinous crimes go up. Homicide tends to go up. This is a consequence of people being together in the same home for longer periods of time. I think let's put a silver lining on it. The country and the people in it are fantastic, and they work together to keep each other safe. I think we are a nation of good neighbors. We do look out for each other. Mm. I think that we recognize that there are challenges, but at the same time, we want to ensure that victims get a voice, as you just said, that perpetrators are brought to justice. We've got through another year. Focus on the one year at a time, one step at a time, Mark. Mm. But I think that I'm hopeful. I remain optimistic that good always wins.
And I think one of the really important messages always is that no matter what's going on around you, no matter how many failings there are within the system, if you feel uncomfortable about something that you've seen, you've heard, or you've experienced, then it's really important you tell someone about it. It's really important you pass it on. There are some great charities out there now, both in terms of child abuse and domestic abuse. There are fire stations now that offer safe venues for people to go to. I urge any of those people who are suffering at Christmas and at a time of year, obviously, when we should all be happy. Sadly, we're not all happy. There are people who will have a horrible Christmas. Yeah. In many, many levels. And I urge those people who are around them, do that right thing, make that phone call, reach out to them and help them, because it is that one opportunity you get. I often say, I remember dealing with a case years and years ago where this young child had cracked his skull. And it was quite clear that it was a non-accidental injury. And I remember speaking to my detective inspector, my supervisor at the time, and I was saying, look, I'm uncomfortable with this. The doctor wouldn't go as far as to say that this was child abuse, but it had the realms of a non-accidental injury. And I said, look, we need to do more investigation. I remember them saying, well, I don't know if we do, I think it's probably okay. And I remember saying to him, do you know what? We get one chance at this. This is our opportunity to get into that family now and dig, and see if there are issues going there. And if we miss that, we may never get the next opportunity, another opportunity. And the next time we might face that family is when that child is seriously injured or dead. And I always remember that. And I always say that to so many people, is that the opportunity that you get, that one time that you get to dig deeper into that family, take it, because you might never get another one.
Yeah. The first contact is the best contact. End of. I mean, early intervention, we know, is what keeps people safe. It's beginning to feel a lot like Christmas.
For our listeners, obviously, we've now been going for a short while. We're here to stay. I think that, I thoroughly enjoy it, Nazir. I hope that you're enjoying it.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. And I hope everybody gets a peaceful Christmas break. And, I hope the 2022 fulfills every one of your wishes and potential.
So I thought next week we should probably have a chat about Savile and sex offences.
Absolutely. They are always in the news, and sadly, every single day you get somebody. But it all started with Watchtale and Savile. So let's go back to where it all began.
Yeah, brilliant. So next week, if you join in, have a listen to Savile. We're going to talk about that case and the impact of that case. And that's really significant, Nazir, isn't it? Because it did change things, not just in terms of authorities, but prosecutions made a big difference.
It did. It's, the reason why we have a podcast called Fear or Favor is because people began to realize that nobody should be above the law, that everybody should be treated equally. And of course, it led to enormous amounts of reporting. Previously, people had no confidence in the system. Suddenly, they thought, actually, the justice system might work for me. So we cannot forget how important those cases were.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for listening again. Join us next week when we will be talking about Savile and the impact of that on the criminal justice system. I wish you a good week, Nazir.
And you too.
Next week, let's catch up. And hopefully it's been a little bit quieter for you.
I hope so too. And for you as well.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much. Have a beautiful Christmas, everybody. Look after yourselves. And Nazir, as always, you're a star. Take care from me and from...
And bye from me as well.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.